morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, worldwide on www.irishradio.com, and on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. So, whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies, inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman. Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I hope you are well settled into 2015 by now. And if any of you acknowledged Little Christmas or Women's Christmas, Nullag na Mann, on Tuesday last, I hope you enjoyed it. I hope that the ladies in your life, as is tradition for the celebration of the Feast of the Epiphany, were able to put their feet up and enjoy their own celebration of Women's Little Christmas. I spent some time living in Cork when I was a student, and I have strong family connections with West Cork. And Nullag na Mann is a big tradition, not only in Cork County, but in Cork City. So to any of those listeners who are tuning in, who, as I said, celebrated Nullag na Mann, I hope you had a good time and you were spoiled a little bit after all the work of Christmas, which all too often lands on us women, unfortunately. We have an interesting program ahead. I had the pleasure of having an opportunity to sit down and have a chat with New Orleans-based historian. As she'll mention, she's actually from New York originally, but has lived in New Orleans for quite a considerable period of time. And she was here in New York over the last week or so, Laura D. Kelly, who's based in New Orleans and has written a fantastic new book on the Irish in New Orleans. The title of the book is, quite simply, The Irish in New Orleans by Laura D. Kelly. And as I said, she was in town as part of a research trip and a talk that she gave on Wednesday evening at the American Irish Historical Society. It was a cold evening here in New York, and if you weren't able to get out to hear Laura talk about her fascinating research on the colourful, entertaining, and often adventurous history of the Irish in New Orleans, sit back and relax. We're going to have a nice long chat with her and hear all about the research she undertook and how she really plots out the story of the Irish in New Orleans from the 18th century right into the 20th century and beyond, you know, bringing it up to today as such in her research. I had the pleasure of being down in New Orleans and was in the heart of the area known as the Irish Channel, which really was the original Irish community. And I mean, not the only concentration of Irish, but where there was the predominant ethnic clustering of the community in the 19th and into the early 20th century. And it's a really interesting place. Generally, it's very interesting to think of the Irish experience there in comparison with New York and, of course, other places in the United States and beyond, because it does have its own unique history, which is slightly different to other places we may be more familiar with. So, as I said, it's my pleasure to have Laura Kelly on the program for the first time and to welcome her to Glucksman Ireland House. I also am delighted to announce that the latest edition of the American Journal of Irish Studies, which is published out of Glucksman Ireland House here at NYU, is hot off the press. We got it in our hands here just before the Christmas break, and it is volume 11 of the American Journal of Irish Studies, which was formerly known as the Journal RIARC, and it is chock-a-block with interesting articles on various aspects of Irish and Irish-American history. I am delighted to let you know that I will have my colleague and friend, Dr. Linda Dowling-Almeida, who is the editor of the American Journal of Irish Studies. She's going to come in and have a chat to us in the coming weeks in detail and give us a little bit of more as to what is covered in the American Journal of Irish Studies. But just to give you an overview, we have an article on Mother Jones by Elliot Gorn. Some of you listeners may have tuned in to the audio, the recording of that event, which was held here at Luxman Ireland House. And this is actually a reproduction of the article that was presented by renowned historian Elliot Gorn on Mother Jones, which is really fascinating. It contains an article by Cathal McQuilla. Any of you who listen to Irish radio, to Radio 1, will be familiar. He is a very well-known radio personality in Ireland in terms of a journalist, and he does the Morning Ireland programme, one of the most popular, if not the most popular, radio shows in Ireland. And his paper is entitled Reflections of a Morning Ireland Presenter, which is really interesting. His career has been a long and varied career, and he's a very, very well thought of journalist. So it's fascinating to have him included in our journal. We also then step back in time. The scholar, historian Walter J. Walsh, who is based out in the West Coast, out in Seattle, I believe. His article is The Work of William Sampson, 1764 to 1836, an interesting article on the life of this man who was so involved in Irish politics or political events in Ireland and here at the turn of the 18th century. And then we have an article by Brian McMahon, Privileged Communication, 1813 to today. We have former Minister Mary Hanafin talking about Irish education. Her article is Irish Education, Rising to the Challenge. We have an article by Hilary Sweeney, who we heard on the programme in recent weeks. Her article is called The Irish and the Urban Workhorse in New York City. And then we have another article by someone who undertook the MA in Irish and Irish American Studies, Daphne Dyer Wolfe. And her article is entitled Theatre and the 19th Century Irish American Identity. And then we have a final article which dips into the archives and is pulled together by the able and talented editor Linda Dowling-Almeida, The Irish and the Horse Carriage Industry in New York City, where Linda goes into the archive quite literally and reproduces some of the excerpts of the fascinating oral histories that have been undertaken on the horse carriage industry in recent months, and which are now preserved at the Archives of Irish America in the Luxman Ireland House Oral History Collection. So it's full of very interesting stuff. If any of you are interested in subscribing to the American Journal of Irish Studies, do get in touch with us. Either send us an email on ireland.house@nyu.edu or give us a call on 212-998-3950. As I mentioned, Dr. Linda Dowling-Almeida will be in to chat and give us a real breakdown of some of the themes and topics covered in this very welcomed Volume 11, American Journal of Irish Studies, over the coming weeks. So if you want to hear more, you will hear more about it very soon. So sit back and relax, folks, and we'll hear from Laura Kelly. I'm here in Luxman Ireland House, NYU, with a visitor from New Orleans. It's a real pleasure to have the historian Laura D. Kelly and author most recently of The Irish in New Orleans here with me. I'm not sure, Laura, if it's your first visit to Luxman Ireland House. Is this the first time you've been here?
No, I'm actually born in New York City.
But is it the first time here in our centre?
It's been a very, very long time.
Okay, but so you have been here before, so yeah. I'm welcoming you back, so to speak. So, Laura, your book was published in recent months, and I know some of our listeners may have had the opportunity to go and hear Laura speak about her research on this book at the American Irish Historical Society during the week. But we wanted to have the opportunity for our Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio, our listeners, to hear Laura talk a little bit
about her interest in the Irish in New Orleans and I guess the origins of this research and how we have ended up with this lovely publication. It's published by University of Louisiana Press. It is available probably most easily bought for people listening on Amazon.com. So Laura, tell us how this book came about.
This book came about, so as I mentioned before, I'm actually originally from New York City, although I haven't lived here in many, many years. I've lived in New Orleans, in fact, for 22 years. But my very first day in New Orleans was taking a taxi from the airport, and the cab driver was speaking to me, and I asked him when he moved to New Orleans, and he said, "I'm from New Orleans," because he had an accent that made him sound like he was from the Bronx. And I was just shocked. I was like, I'm in the South, and like, how can you, you sound like you just came straight out of New York City. And he told me that he was from the Channel, the Irish Channel. And I flabbergasted further, and I said, "The Irish Channel, what Irish?" And he's like, you got to go down the Channel. And to this day, I still can't do the accent. But I became fascinated with the fact that there were Irish in New Orleans. And with a last name like Kelly, my own grandfather was from County Roscommon, I just had never heard of it before. And as it turns out, many people were unaware of the Irish in New Orleans. And so that became the focus of my research and ultimately a dissertation and then this book. And in fact, every fall at Tulane University, I teach a course on the Irish in New Orleans. So that's where it all started. So you never know what's going to happen in a taxi ride. When people think of New Orleans, they often think, they'll say French, Spanish, Creole, but they don't think about the other immigrant groups there. And New Orleans was, before the Civil War, the second largest port in America, second only to New York City. And so, like New York City, we got a huge number of Irish during the famine, but not only during the 1840s and 1850s. And in fact, in the research that I conducted, it turns out that the Irish had been there at the very inception of the city, which is 1718. So we're coming up to our 300-year anniversary. But what makes the Irish experience in New Orleans different than New York City or Boston or Philadelphia or really anywhere else is that New Orleans was part of Louisiana, part of first a French colony and then a Spanish colony. And so it's not at all part of that 13 colony British experience. And this means that the Irish that are going to New Orleans in the 1700s during the French colonial period and the Spanish colonial period are Catholic. They're not those, we would later call the Scotch-Irish. We're not getting Presbyterians. And in fact, we're getting Irish that are doing kind of a two-step jump before they even get to the Louisiana colony. Because part of that, that wild geese, part of those families that left Ireland due to persecution, seeking better opportunities, and that first went to either France or went to Spain, established themselves there in the business or military or a bit of both. And then when Louisiana, French colony, Spanish colony, they came over in that period. And so you get in the records these fabulous names like Alejandro O'Reilly, Juan O'Connor, Santiago Murray. And they're coming to New Orleans for the same reason French or Spanish are coming, and that's for opportunity, or again, military. So in the 18th century, we see this kind of combination of Irish coming, but not necessarily the formation of an Irish community so much. Like you have a bunch of individuals. And I guess the real question is when do a bunch of individuals of one background become a community, become an ethnic community, become an identifiable community? And in New Orleans, we see that what we call the early American period. So 1803's Louisiana Purchase, that's when New Orleans joins the recently created United States. And most of the Creole population of the city didn't want to be American. They didn't like the idea of being American. They had tremendous trepidations about these Protestants. And even though we have the concept of freedom of religion, they had no experience in it, and they kind of kept expecting Americans to come in and force them to become Protestants. It didn't help that our governor, William Claiborne, didn't speak a lick of French or Spanish. But the Irish that were there didn't have those ambivalent feelings at all, because sort of the last wave of Irish that we got in New Orleans was as a result of that 1798 failed rebellion. And so they're arriving in New Orleans. It's still technically Spanish when the Americans buy it in 1803. But to them, the Americans, from an Irish perspective, the American Revolution has one lesson and one lesson only. You can beat the British. And so put that in, you know, the context of an Irishman and even their own, you know, just recently, in their minds, recently failed 1798 rebellion, this was the idea, wait, this can be done. And there's no other example of this in the British Empire, not at that time. And so while they weren't crazy with the Protestant and, you know, other aspects to it, it didn't strike them as hard as it did like other Catholic populations in Louisiana. And in fact, they pretty much like to remind people that the Irish fought in the American Revolution, that the Irish were part of the, you know, win, and the victory over the British was due to Irish soldiers in the American Revolution. And so going back to the question of like, when does an ethnic identity form? When can you say you have a community? You look at several markers as a historian, and one of them is when do you have like the first and then thereafter continuous celebration of a public saint's day, public feast day. And of course for the Irish it's St. Patrick's Day. And I found in the newspapers as early as March 1806, they're publicly celebrating St. Patrick's Day. Now, again, you have to put this in context of the Louisiana Purchase, because that's just in, technically, official transfer happens in December 1803. So this is only 2.5 years. And like St. Patrick's Day parades today, then they were politicized. You know, the governor was there. Lots of judges were there. But what I really enjoy was, and they printed it in the newspaper, and I have them in the book, the official 17 toast. And what also is interesting is that every year they increase them. So by 1818, they're like up to 21 toasts. And I don't know how well they're standing at that point, but the toasts tell us a lot, because they celebrate and they praise General Washington, not President Washington. And so, again, there are these subtle reminders of the American Revolution. There's reminders of they're fighting it. And, of course, also in 1806, we're in the lead up to the War of 1812. And what's that about but another conflict with Britain? And often historians refer to it as the Second American Revolution. And, of course, it's a war that's really known for its stalemates and its failures and the burning down of our capital. But it's also known for the great triumphant at the very end, Battle of New Orleans, which although technically happens after the war had ended, after the treaty was signed, word had not gotten out. And in fact, January 8th, 2015 is the 200-year anniversary of the Battle of New Orleans. And this is fought with General Andrew Jackson, the son of, you know, Irish immigrants, against General Packenham, an Anglo-Irish himself. And in fact, he loses his life in the Battle of New Orleans. Jackson obviously doesn't. He goes on to become president. So you have this Irish involvement politically, militarily as well, because another marker is when do militias form? And, you know, at a day and age when every community had militias, if not several, because you didn't have a large standing army, we see in the War of 1812, the Irish in New Orleans have formed the Republican Greens, which again kind of tell us that mentality of the Irish. These are for an independent Republic of Ireland. And then another marker is when do you get the charitable societies, the philanthropic ones. And that happens in New Orleans in 1818 with, you know, after the fall of Napoleon, and then Ireland itself gets hit with some crop disasters and typhus and smallpox outbreaks. And we see that wave of poorer, more Irish Catholics, especially men, starting to come to the United States, building the transportation network of the United States, digging canals. And so we get a benevolent society, a Hibernian benevolent society. And then the last marker, of course, is the church. When do you have an ethnic church? And New Orleans, for all of it being a Catholic city, and we discuss this often among historians and locally as well, from its formation in 1718, over 100 years later, there's only one church, St. Louis Cathedral, and one chapel, the Ursuline Chapel. The next church to be built in New Orleans happens in the 1830s, and it's St. Patrick's Church. And to give you an idea, you know, of geographic location and messages being sent, Canal Street's the great dividing line in New Orleans. And 7 blocks from Canal Street going downriver is St. Louis Cathedral. And 7 blocks going upriver from Canal Street is St. Patrick's. So you have this Irish community that's formed kind of the early antebellum period that is not the famine. You know, they're not famine immigrants. And when they start to pour in the 1840s, there's a base there already. But if we have a foundation, it's the famine immigrants that build the structure of the Irish community. Really, the whole house, all floors of it. It's the golden age of church building with the famine immigrants coming in, the communities, and they just dot the riverside and they continue up. Churches, parochial schools, orphanages, and we were lucky in New Orleans to have a very sympathetic archbishop that really cohered with that vision of the Irish and this idea of the neighborhood church, the immigrant church, because it's not one that existed before. So again, there's different types of Catholicism. And the Creole population practiced what we called latitudinarian. And if you can spell that and say it, the next beer is on me. But what it means is that's a very liberal view of Catholicism. Well, not liberal view, but it's more liberal. And there's less emphasis on the sacraments, while the Irish, along with the Germans for that matter, but the Irish practice what we call Tridentine, which places a huge amount of emphasis on the sacraments. It's much more of an interactive church. It's much more expectations from the church, but you also give back to the church. And while I think our Creoles, we would probably today call them more of our Easter Christmas Catholics, and, you know, going for the baptisms, occasionally going Sundays, confession maybe once a year, maybe. And the Irish come in and they're just abhorred by the way the Creoles are practicing, the way they treat the archbishop. So I guess it's no surprise that the archbishop sort of embraced and followed the Irish desire for these neighborhood churches. But again, and you know, your listeners may or may not know, but the archbishop can give you permission to build a church and create a parish. But the archbishop doesn't give you the money to build the church. It doesn't sort of say, here you go. And that money comes from the community. So I'm just struck when you see these beautiful churches, and they're literally built by the parishioners. You know, this is an effort of blood, sweat, and tears, and toil, and free time, and pennies. And you look at them, and they're these beautiful edifices, and they're going up almost simultaneously around the city, 1848, 1850, 1852. And the minute they're done with the church, they're building the parochial school, and oftentimes they're building them with brick, they're building them with stone, and all of southern Louisiana, not just in New Orleans, but in all of southern Louisiana, there's no natural stone. So these are things that bricks had to be made either across Lake Pontchartrain or even brought in from Chicago. Other places, stone had to be brought in. And yes, they did build wooden churches first, sort of as temporary structures, but then they went on to build these stone edifices. And it was another symbol to the community of, I think, a certain amount of pride, a certain amount of dedication and devotion, and a certain amount of, if there had been any prejudice, of which there was, against the Irish, it's kind of a, yes, look what we can do, look at our community. And so all of this is going on, and New Orleans is this thriving port city, second largest port in America, fourth largest in the world. Then the Civil War happens, and everything changes. And this is again where the New Orleans story differs from the story of New York or Boston or anywhere else. And in fact, New Orleans, like, you know, 1850, let's say, like in the middle of the famine, had a per capita population of Irish percentage that was higher than Philadelphia, higher than Baltimore, on par, maybe even slightly higher than Boston. So New Orleans is a very much an Irish city. It's 25% Irish. When you're walking down the street, you know, every fourth person you run into is speaking with an Irish brogue like yourself. But unlike places like Boston or New York, after 1860, we don't continue to get those immigrants coming in. Because what's an immigrant's primary concern, first and foremost? economic. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if you're Irish or if you're Korean. And you go where there is economic opportunity. And the Civil War changes all of that for New Orleans. I mean, first, New Orleans gets captured in 1862. And so we're kind of pretty much removed from that scene. And then during the Civil War, the Transcontinental Railroad is being built. And it's completed in 1865. And what does that do? It connects east and west and leaves the South out. And so not only does the South lose the war, but they're cut out of that new transportation network. And while steamboats are still very important, it's not the same when the Mississippi was the main transportation network before railroad. And then King Cotton is no longer king, and you know the prices become depreciated, and the whole South falls into an economic slump. And so while New Orleans still has more opportunity than other places in the South, from an immigrant's point of view, it has a lot less opportunity. And so we are sort of flood of Irish immigrants that were coming in before slows to a trickle and then to a drip.
Can I ask you, Laura, in that era, say up to the Civil War, you know, in the 1840s, 1850s, when you're basically talking about famine migration, have you a sense of anything that differentiated an Irish immigrant in terms of why some came to New York or Boston or Philadelphia and why others went to New Orleans? Is there anything occupationally, geographically, class or social status in Ireland? Is there any generalization that you have kind of seen that differentiated why they came to certain places?
No. It would be the very short answer to that. There was a good reason to come in the sense that 9/10 of all Irish immigrants left from, you know, Liverpool. And the ticket price from Liverpool to New York or Liverpool to New Orleans was just about the same. So if you're in Liverpool, and, you know, by the time you got to Liverpool, if you're deciding where to go and you don't have a family connection or something like this, at least those are the same prices. And those were pretty much the cheapest ones. You may go to New Orleans thinking, I'll travel up the Mississippi and then maybe go into the interior, whether or not you ever actually do. But that's also why we have these sizable Irish populations in, like, St. Louis, because they're traveling up the Mississippi. The gold rush happens in 1849, so we do see mention in the records with women and children who have been left behind and the man left from New Orleans to go out to California.
I'm wondering, well, I suppose it would hold the same here, but just because of the harbor and the location of New Orleans, would it have had a tendency to attract people? I mean, that's not going to differentiate it greatly from the likes of New York, but would it have attracted people who are interested in stuff to do with seafaring or things like that?
You know, I don't think so. I think it's just, I think New Orleans just offered a lot of opportunity, economic, and I think the word is out there. Jobs are available. This is also a huge amount of construction. If you ever go to New Orleans, so much of what you see in the Garden District and other areas, they're all being built in this 19th century. So there isn't just the work that would have been associated with the port. Yeah, the added benefit, it is a Catholic city. There's also no quarantine. And, you know, these kinds of messages do spread and they get back and, you know, this place may be harder to get into, but this place. And I think the quarantine issue is important because the famine immigrants coming in, they're not at the best of health and of no fault of their own. And I think this idea that you might be worried that you might get rejected or something like this, that wouldn't have happened because there wasn't one. But what the records have shown, which I find interesting, is this conscious decision to come to New Orleans. And you see this with the children. So you have a nice Irish family of, let's say, 8 children. And the first 2 will be born in Ireland, and then the next one might be born in New York, and then the next one born in Kentucky, and then the next one in Ohio. But the last 2 are born in New Orleans. And you see this pattern repeated quite a bit, and even traveling with really small infants, like, you know, one is 2 years old, born in Ohio, one's 1 year old, born in Kentucky, and, you know, and then they've arrived. And they're, you know, the last 2 are there. And following the children's telling me is this decision, even traveling with small children, to make it to New Orleans and then to stay in New Orleans. So there was sort of an argument that one historian was putting forth that the Irish got stuck in New Orleans. Like, they didn't choose to come there. They got stuck when they arrived there. And the records show the opposite. They show this real conscious decision of working their way, often through the waterways, which is why you usually see Ohio, Kentucky, or Tennessee for the birthplaces. And then again, the last several, they're all New Orleans. They're not moving from mm-hmm. New Orleans. They're not continuing on sort of migratory path. I do know for New Orleans that it's roughly about 50% of the men worked as laborers, but 50% didn't. And that 50%, the occupation ranged from blacksmith to cooper, from doctor to druggist, from, you know, lawyer to school teacher. And so there's a great diversity in the occupations. And I'm always sort of telling my students that just because in 1850 you're listed as a laborer doesn't mean that in 1855 you're still a laborer. You know, again, you may have just gotten off the boat a year ago and you're out there doing manual labor because you have to feed yourself, you have to feed your family and get yourself situated. But you may also have other skills, and, you know, like present day would be taxi cab drivers and the immigrant population. And so you look at opportunity and means and funds, and one snapshot does not condemn you to that. But again, that sort of 50% are doing these other occupations also, I think, tells you of that diversity. And like New York, it's a port city. So perhaps, I don't know, when as an immigrant you feel more comfortable in a city with other immigrants, you know, less likely to stand out.
Mm-hmm. The thing that, you know, talking about this, Laura, and being in New Orleans, which I had the pleasure to be recently, that great conference that you organized, talking about New Orleans in the context of famine migration, it forces me to think about thinking historically,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, I asked the question, well, why were they going to New Orleans? Why not? When you
yeah.
put yourself in the mindset of an immigrant leaving Ireland at this point in time, and you look at the statistics and see mm-hmm. there were so many going there, our perceptions of it is skewed now because we know what happens next. We
yes,
know that it drops off.
Mm-hmm.
So now that's why I'm asking these really kind of ignorant questions when you think about it.
No.
You know, it's why wouldn't they go there? Of course
yeah.
they would go there on some levels. And it's just very interesting just to think of us as historians in terms of what we're doing, and not only just in immigrant history or the history of migration, but just more generally in terms of thinking historically. They didn't know what was going to come next.
No, they didn't. And if they had, they would have left Ireland much sooner or done something else before 1845. No, I think also New Orleans poses another great question
mm-hmm.
that, again, distinguishes it from other places in the sense that you usually need an infusion of, almost a continual infusion of immigrants to keep that ethnic identity alive, because after so many generations, you're just going to sort of become American. You usually lose that, or the semblance to that ethnicity can get sort of watered down to maybe just, you know, getting drunk on St. Patrick's Day and that's it. What I found fascinating about the Irish in New Orleans is that identity after the Civil War coheres and gets stronger rather than becoming more assimilated. And, you know, it's 1870s when the Hibernia Bank is formed and given its name, you know, obviously had love Irish Americans that founded it. And it remains the Hibernia Bank until 2005 when Capital One bought it. The Ancient Order of Hibernians come to New Orleans in the 1870s. But they continue on and mold. And in my book, I tried, but pretty much every chapter and every subject, to bring it up to the present day. And because if there was one thing I wanted the reader to take away with, is that this is not just something that happened in the past a long time ago and we're just sort of looking backwards at this and examining it, but it's something that is actually brought forward to the present. And the 1941 WPA records, so out of the Great Depression, they sent down all these journalists and writers and other people, employed them, and they went into the Irish Channel in New Orleans, into this neighborhood, and they just went around interviewing all these people, which is fantastic, because you're really hearing the voices of this working, lower middle class, up to middle class neighborhood. We would never hear their voices, you know, the occasional letter. But sometimes they're just like conversations, these transcripts that are written down. And what I found striking about them, it's 1941, is how strong that Irish identity is. And, you know, there hasn't been an Irish immigrant there for the most part for several generations. Mm-hmm. And you can't shake it. So to me, that kind of poses other questions. Why? Why do they have this? You know, why do they maintain it? What does it mean to them? And, you know, they use the term the way a lot of Americans use the term. And they say, oh, I'm Irish, meaning, you know, I'm Irish-American. But again, what is it they're holding on to? Because it's not like they're Irish Catholics living in a predominantly, you know, Protestant city, so they may have like that defensive nature. No, they're just one more Catholic group along with a bunch of other Catholic groups. And English-speaking, you know, the Irish, oh, going back actually to my beginning story with the taxi cab driver. So the reason why my taxi cab driver sounded like he came from New York City is because when New Orleans started to switch primarily from French as its main language over to English, it was done at the same time as the massive wave of Irish immigrants with the famine. And so a very similar accent developed coincidentally, because this is when New Orleans started to speak English, or English started becoming the primary language of the city. So it's that question of, like, why do you have that identity and what does it mean? Which is, to me, another sort of fascinating one, and one that a historian doesn't always necessarily get to broach.
One topic that came up a little bit, Laura, when you hosted that conference I mentioned in November as part of celebrating New Orleans as the famine city.
The 2014 International Famine City.
One of the topics that you discussed, and unfortunately I didn't arrive in New Orleans in time to catch it, was the famine in the context of more recent history of New Orleans and mm-hmm. Hurricane Katrina. Would you mind just talking a little bit about, you know, the parallels or otherwise in terms of looking at a disaster from very different vantage points in terms of chronology, et cetera, et cetera?
So the Republic of Ireland, as a little background, the Republic of Ireland chooses a city in the diaspora that took in a whole bunch of famine refugees and commemorates it for taking in the Irish during this horrific period in their history. And New Orleans was chosen as that 2014 city, and we had a four-day event, as you mentioned, in November. And my talk was entitled, "The Water Giveth and the Water Taketh Away." And I'd come across this great quote by Herodotus, I'm going to not say that correctly, but it said that no man steps in the same river twice. And I thought about that and the poignancy of it, because these immigrants, so many of them came up the Mississippi. They came via water. Water itself is what made that fungus so deadly and spread the blight over Ireland. And I thought about the way disaster defines a community, both its resilience and the strategies it employs, the survival mechanisms, and there's a tremendous amount of positives that can come with water, and a huge destructive force, as we saw with the levee failure during Katrina, because it wasn't the hurricane that was the problem, it was a man-made problem with the levees failing, and our city was 80% underwater. And there were connections both historically with New Orleans taking in these famine immigrants and these immigrants making it their home there and not moving on, as I had mentioned before. And then during Katrina, the Republic of Ireland actually sent over money and sent over aid. And so there was, you know, a much more recent connection with Ireland and unfortunately surrounding in disaster. But I found, the more I thought about it, that in our sort of post-Katrina world, thereafter Katrina and like with the Irish immigrants, there was a lot of parallels. And one of them is, in New Orleans, we came up with a motto pretty quickly, and that was rebirth, rebuild, rejoice. And it became like a mantra for us, and we held on to it because this was incredibly difficult times, and difficult times for a long time. And I thought about that parallel with an immigrant, those, you know, nearly 2 million that made the decision to leave and the hardship of that. I think sometimes we forget about how hard it is to leave your village, your county that you probably had never left and family members had never left, to travel across Ireland, to get on one boat, to get on another boat, to come to a foreign land, and knowing that it was going to be a one-way ticket. That is a rebirth in itself. very much a rebirth and a rebuilding. That's what immigrants do. That's what the Irish did. They rebuilt their life, and they rebuilt it with the means and the tools that they had at hand. And you did it, and you succeeded, in large part based on the strength of community and family. And that's how it happened in New Orleans. You know, for weeks and weeks and weeks, months even, people would just put up cardboard signs and say what business had opened up, put up cardboard signs saying, you know, bring your brooms to Magazine Street, this section, and people would show up and just start cleaning it. And so it was that community. And then there was, of course, the national discourse, well, should New Orleans even rebuild? Should we be doing this? Should they even be wasting their effort? And so I thought about that strength of community that says, yes, I will do this, and this is important, and this is why. But again, it has to come from the ground. It has to come from within in order to make it strong without. And to me, that is essentially the strength of Irish communities anywhere, in New Orleans or elsewhere, is that it comes from within and based in large part on kinship networks. And then, of course, the final part of that is rejoice. Because what we do in New Orleans is we celebrate life. And we celebrate life in the face of sometimes horrible disaster, and we're unapologetic about it. And I think, again, an immigrant is rejoicing at that as well.
One last question, Laura. You've been really generous with your time with us today. Can you just give us a little sense of the present in terms of how New Orleanians self-identify as being Irish today? I'm thinking especially in the context of them not being just Irish, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. People in New Orleans must be a bit Creole, a bit Spanish, a bit French, a bit Irish, a bit German, Italian and stuff like that. Based on your experience, and I know you don't mm-hmm. work exclusively on the Irish, and in a sense you can answer this question better because you have knowledge of other groups. What is it that brings out the Irish, though, card where, you know, someone who is 6th or 7th or 8th generation Irish and it's only part of it, where it's the Irish they're self-identifying as? Or do people in New Orleans self-identify in that way, in the same way as we hear in New York?
Yes, they do, very much. And so New Orleanians, like New York, is based upon neighborhoods also. And so there's a very strong identity with the neighborhood that you live in. And we have many, many neighborhoods. And so, you know, HBO made a whole series on the Treme, but that's one neighborhood. The Irish Channel is another neighborhood. They're all around the city. And so that's kind of like the first nucleus where people identify. But they do identify Irish, even though, as you say, they've been 6, 7, 8, who knows how many generations, and have usually Italian and German in there. But what's striking about them is that familiar pattern that you see in other places. And the Irish have been marrying Irish, have been marrying Irish, have been marrying Irish. And occasionally you get an Italian in there or a German. And World War One and World War Two quashed anybody's desire, I think, to associate themselves with being German. The only competition I've seen is maybe with Italians. And that then depends upon the family identity. Because I, you know, when writing this book, I was interviewing a lot of people, and I would hear that, oh, I've got this Italian side and stuff, but it was sort of like pushed off to the side. And I think for like a lot of Americans, and especially when you have been in this country for so many generations, it's a matter of choice. And our former ambassador from Ireland, Michael Collins, which is such a great name for an ambassador, he'd asked him that same question. He said, why, when essentially we're mutts in so many ways, why would an American with these different heritages pick that one? And I was interested in that question too when he posed it. So I started to ask my students this question, started asking anybody. And my students came up with some of the best answers. I had one, Tommy O'Brien. And he said, well, you know, people would hear my name and O'Brien, they'd be like, oh, you little Irish boy, you little this. And they would just start to push this identity on him. And so it was external. But most of them, it's internal and external. So the family is telling stories. It's telling them about Ireland. It's telling them the history. It's talking about the British and negative manners. And it's perpetuating these things. And then externally, Irish names are so recognizable that you have a society, you have a group that says this. And then, you know, I think after Kennedy, being Irish just became cool, and lucky for us, it continues to be so. But today in New Orleans, or certainly like the last 10 years in New Orleans, I've seen sort of a real greening of the city or a resurgence of the Irish in the city. And by this, I mean Irish born coming to New Orleans and from a variety of different backgrounds, from lawyers to restaurants to pub owners to musicians. And again, through the writing of this book, interviewed a lot of them, talked to them, became friends. And I'd always sort of like, you know, ask them why New Orleans. And quite a few of them had lived in other places in the States before, so they didn't come directly from Ireland. And what brought them here was usually different stories, but the reason they stayed was almost uniformly the same answer. And they said New Orleans reminded them of home. They said they wake up in the morning, they hear the church bells, people are so gregarious, and they don't mind in New Orleans stopping, talking to you, asking after your mother, asking after your family. They're not in a rush. Work is not the primary objective. Community, spending time, enjoying life is. And that they just feel like home. And it's not as big of a jump. They're not so much a stranger in a strange land, and the homesickness is less there. And so today, I think that's what New Orleans has to offer the Irish, and I think that's why Irish born are there, and then they themselves are also embraced and enveloped in an Irish-American community.
Well, listen, Laura, I could talk to you here all day about this. It's fascinating to just dip the toe in terms of the research that you have condensed into this lovely book. I really highly recommend it, folks. The Irish in New Orleans by Laura D. Kelly, University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. As we mentioned earlier, probably most easily available to people listening in the tri-state area or in other places via Amazon.com.
And I should also say it's visually beautiful.
Absolutely.
It's a visually beautiful book. There's lots of historic photos, contemporary photos. Each chapter is sort of a standalone chapter. So there's a chapter on parades. There's a chapter on one of our favorite local pubs, Finn McCool's. There's the historic chapter. So you can pick it up and put it down. But I don't think there's a single page in that book that doesn't have a beautiful photograph.
No, and what's great about it, Laura, is to your credit, it bridges the, you know, sometimes us historians are writing for about 10 other people in the world who are going to read our very theoretical or specific history or research or whatever. And this very nicely bridges that divide of being historically grounded and academically grounded and very well researched with something that is very readable and also visually very attractive. So if you're in the humor for something that will open your mind a little bit on the experience of the Irish somewhere outside of New York, this is highly recommendable. And I hope, Laura, that we will hear from you again soon and that you'll be back to New York. I know you're dying to get back to the heat,
relative warmth. It was 75 degrees when I left New Orleans, so that's my idea of winter. But I also invite anybody in the tri-state area to come down to New Orleans, experience Ireland, the Irish of New Orleans, and do so maybe during the winter months when it's so cold up here and it's not down there.
It's a very interesting city, and the Irish experience of it there is fascinating. Thanks for coming in today, Laura.
Thank you so much.
In the interview with Dr. Laura Kelly, she referenced the 1806 St. Patrick's Day toasts she had uncovered in her research. I believe they were reproduced in the Orleans Gazette around the time of the feast for St. Patrick being held. And these toasts are rather interesting to hear and give an insight into the political landscape and outlook of the Irish in New Orleans around this time. It's quite interesting, and I thought it would be interesting for you to hear these toasts as they were celebrated at this time. So I'll start off and work down through them. The day we celebrate. The Mother of All Saints. The President of the United States. May his wife and vigorous counsels be supported by an energetic Congress. The memory of General Washington. The armies that fight for the independence of their country. The Army of the United States. The Navy of the United States. The commerce of the United States.
May its resources continue ready to maintain the rights and dignity of the country. The venerable clergy throughout the continent of America, may their influence ever be employed in the cause of freedom. The Irish shamrock, may it find a congenial soil in the plains of Louisiana. The territory of Orleans, may its inhabitants soon enjoy all the privileges of American citizens. The memory of General Montgomery, one of the first who taught Irishmen to bleed for their adopted country. General Eaton, a handful of brave men is worth more than a million of dastards. The three C's of Louisiana, cane, cotton, and corn. The King of Spain, may all his dominion be soon restored to their ancient independence. Our American brethren, may the resources of their country be applied to its aggrandissement. The fair of Louisiana, may the sons of St. Patrick ever deserve and be blessed with their smiles. Volunteers, the true son of St. Patrick, may the Americans ever receive them as brethren. General Moreau and the brave Frenchmen who prefer exile to slavery. So they're all the toasts that were celebrated at St. Patrick's Day in 1806 in New Orleans. It does really, as Laura mentioned, give an insight into how the Irish in this city at the time are placing themselves and looking out on the world, looking out on the American political and military situation and the relationship with Ireland. It really is an interesting document. I don't know how sober any of them would have been after celebrating, marking all those toasts, but who knows, maybe they were well practiced at this and were taking small sips.
I'm John Waters, I'm the director of the Irish and Irish American Studies Master's Program at NYU. Ireland is an extraordinary object of study in the contemporary humanities and social sciences. It's a small country on a global scale, a small population with an incredible cultural impact. Our MA program is an interdisciplinary MA program and a transdisciplinary MA program. We're able to work with students who come to study Irish literature, to study Irish history, to study Irish music, to study Irish culture. All of them find a really dynamic home for their passions and their interests here at Glucksman Ireland House.
We approach the Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies in a way that attempts to kind of break down disciplinary boundaries that sometimes impede the ability to really get a rounded understanding of a culture or of a history or of a society.
It incorporates almost every single part of Irish culture that you can get. It's not just Irish history. It's not just Irish literature or language or culture or music. It's a little bit of everything.
New York is actually an excellent place to pursue Irish studies. A steady stream of visitors is constantly arriving in New York from Ireland, and so we're able to capitalize on a really vital stream of Irish culture that continues to renew the presence of Irish cultural life in New York City. We're based in a landmark building on Washington Mews, which is a picturesque, quaint street at the very bottom of Fifth Avenue, right across the street from the Washington Square Arch. So we're in a very dynamic physical location. But we're also host to a dynamic internal energy.
The Irish experience is actually a key part of understanding the ethnic experience of New York City and the growth of the city and the development of the city into what it is today.
We're committed to the idea that a very large part of Irish historical experience has taken place outside of Ireland. We think we've actually fashioned a lens for the study of the Irish experience here in New York that really wouldn't be available anyplace else in the world.
The Glucksman Ireland House is at the center of New York City, which is the center of Irish and Irish American studies, period.
This is where novelists, poets, essayists, historians, sociologists, anthropologists, this is where they want to come to launch their work in New York.
We have welcomed people like current President of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins, former President Mary Robinson, Bono.
Recently, Nobel Prize winner Seamus Heaney came and spoke very eloquently about how he sees the contribution of Ireland House into Irish cultural life. If James Joyce were alive and wanted to launch a new book in the United States, Buxman Ireland House at NYU is where he would launch it.
NYU offers a summer in Dublin program whereby students travel and spend 6 weeks at Trinity College in Dublin, the oldest university in Ireland.
I studied abroad at Trinity through the NYU Glucksman Ireland House last summer. It really connects the experience that you have here studying, you know, history or the language or literature to something concrete and real.
Dublin's a really interesting and enjoyable experience for students. It's right in the middle of summer. There's a lot going on in the city in terms of cultural events. So students actually live on campus and study, take their classes on campus in Trinity.
One of the things that sets our summer study abroad program apart is the extent to which we get our students outside of Dublin.
Every single place that you go to in Ireland, every county has a wildly different, you know, culture or community than the county next door. We got to go see the west of Ireland. We went to Inishbofin, which is a tiny island about a 45-minute ferry ride off the coast of Galway. We went to Northern Ireland as well, which was really, really cool.
One of the most impressive places for me, I think, was Tory Island, because it is a very remote place that a lot of Irish people don't even go to and are very surprised when you tell them that you've been there. And we got to meet the king of Tory Island, who gave us a tour and was an incredibly interesting man. And it was just a really cool experience to have that, where most Irish people even would be surprised to hear that you've done this.
In addition to planned trips, students also have free time where we allow them to travel all over Ireland, and they've gone to extraordinary places on their own. Our students have really come away from that experience of studying in Ireland with an incredibly positive view of the country and of the program that's brought them there.
It is by far one of the best things I've ever done, and if I could go back and do it again, I'd do it every single summer.
The majority of our courses are offered between 6 and 9 in the evening here at Ireland House, and that enables people who are working full-time to pursue the degree by doing one or two courses a semester. It's a challenge to be a graduate student today, there's no doubt about that. We're now actually in a position to give financial support, up to 50% of financial aid, to students pursuing the program either full-time or part-time. And we're really excited about that, because we think people with the passion deserve that kind of support.
We're coming towards the end of the program for another week. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and on HD Radio, on irishradio.com, and on nyuirish.net/radiohour. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, my email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu, and our phone number is 212-998-3950. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to our website at www.nyu.irish.net/radiohour or go to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanley Show up next on WBNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, do stay with us until noon. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus fanacht.